I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty. Oh.
They say a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 162. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going great, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. I was just thinking, at 162, that's like a tenth of the number of games that are in a baseball season. Or is it? No, it's close to the number.
It is precisely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
160. I mean, they're in groups of 10, though. It's too strenuous to actually count them all out. So I'm pretty sure this is a tenth of it. But that's just what it feels like. Anyway, really excited to be with you guys today. We've got fun Andrew Was Wrong segment. Oh, those are always good.
Not at all lengthy Andrew Was Wrong segment. How about that?
Yeah, it's always some minor thing, but it's still fun it's fun to point out when Andrew is wrong so we can feel like we're somehow as smart as Andrew, you know, by bringing him down to our level. I think that's what we're all trying to do here. And then we're going to talk about the tariffs against China. That's really interesting. Can't wait to learn about that. And then we're going to take a brief saunter up to Yodel Mountain, check in, see what's going on around there. What do you think? Should we get started?
You gotta yodel every Friday.
Yeah.
Until the end of time or the end of the Trump administration, whichever comes first.
Right. And, right.
You know, but I'm not sure where my money is, but,
but in the meantime, you have a law practice that you wanted to maybe talk about. people don't know. No, they do know.
Yeah, I do. I get a fair number of questions. We get questions in the Opening Arguments email inbox as well that say, hey, you know, is this what you do? Do you also still practice law? That sort of thing. And I basically split my time about, you know, 50-50 between the show and seeing actual clients. And so I continue to work with primarily entrepreneurs, people who are starting businesses, and small businesses. And I work in both the litigation capacity and also in what lawyers call the kind of the corporate capacity, which is drafting documents, that sort of thing. And so some of our longtime listeners know that, you know, one of the things that I've helped people do is draft contracts, draft operating agreements, start businesses, file LLCs, stuff like that. And so if you are a listener and you don't have a relationship with a business attorney and you like the show and you'd like to have one, shoot me an email at it's P.A. Torres, P-A-T-O-R-R-E-Z, at patorres.com. One of the nice things about having your own firm is you get to have your name in the domain name. And just put, you know, OA client or OA listener or something in the box so that I know where it's coming. And I'd be happy to talk to you about your business. And that is 100% the way in which I get new clients. And, you know, one of the luxuries about doing the show is I get to pick who I work with, but it's always fun to work with people who are fans of the show. So
Yeah, he doesn't just play a lawyer on TV, everyone. Yeah. Actual lawyer.
Yeah, I've got to, you know, it would be, I think, a disservice to the show if I wasn't actually putting the stuff into practice that we talk about. So,
Plus, we mentioned it, but just to hit on quickly, with that new tax bill, as much as, you know, we didn't agree with it, it may be wise for some of you out there to form new business entities, that kind of thing. So it's a good time to talk to Andrew Torres.
Thank you very much.
Andrew, also, we got to do a quick bracket update. I got second. That's all I know. Was there other things about it? But I know that I got second.
Yeah,
pretty good.
If the challenge, which retroactively we can make the challenge, is beat Thomas at picking your March Madness bracket.
Then literally only then, one
yeah,
person
that's right.
That.
So here are our top five. In fifth place, Michael Schaefer with 111. Yay.
Hey, I met Michael Schaefer.
In fourth place, Eric Brewer with 112.
All right.
In third place, with 113 points, Stephanie St. Amour. In second place, also with 113 points, but closer on the tiebreaker, as I predicted, Thomas Smith.
Ooh.
And in first place, as I said last week, with the Villanova championship running away with this thing, 128 points, is Isaac Drips. Congratulations, Isaac. Hey, shoot us an email and congratulations.
Yeah, but by the way, Andrew, you were wrong about whatever the heck you were saying, because if Loyola whatever had, or what's the Chicago one, if they had won, I still would have won with Villanova victory. That was whatever you're saying was wrong. But anyway, congratulations.
I am not doing an Andrew was wrong segment on that. We have enough Andrew was wrong in this episode.
Yeah, that's true. So don't hire Andrew for your bracketology needs. Should I reveal my secret? My secret to this bracket thing is it allows you to do two, by the way. So I already feel, you know, this was my second entry. I feel a little, feel like I cheated a little bit on that. But, you know, a lot of people did too. My first one, I did all kinds of upsets. And my second bracket, I literally just picked by the numbers and then picked the top, what I thought was the best team to win. So no upsets plus Villanova. And I got second. So let that be a lesson to you all.
All right. Always play it conservative. That's Thomas's official advice. Yeah.
Good times. Well, good bracket update. Thanks for participating. Hey, are we going to try to get a NHL
playoff? Oh, yeah. Oh, that'll be...
People were asking for an NHL playoff bracket. I mean, I doubt as many people will be interested in that, but hey, well, maybe we'll do one. We'll share it in the opening arguments group just for fun. It's another thing we can all suck at and together, and then someone will win and it'll be fun.
I agree. It's always fun.
All right. We'll do it in the group.
You know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
All right. Well, now that we've had all that, I don't know, Andrew, that you wanted to do this, but you put your pitch pitch for your firm right before we talk about what you're wrong about. It's going to be like
hire the worst lawyer on earth.
Oh, no. So we got just a deluge of emails on this one particular thing. So you want to take it away?
I will. So this is an official Andrew was wrong segment. I want to do it in increasing order of severity, which is probably in decreasing order of the degree to which we were yelled at via email and in Twitter. But now look, like I believe very strongly in accountability, and the there are five of these. The fifth segment is something I feel very strongly about correcting, but I want to correct on everything, right? So, number one, what did we get? 100 emails and messages on Twitter and Facebook and the like regarding my off the cuff description of 22 rimfire ammo in our last episode. And I want to say again, this is my plea to you, the gun enthusiasts who have written in. I want you to go back and listen to how I described the 22 ammo. Not listen word for word, but listen to the gist, because I've engaged with some of you, and I think that the way in which I described it in general gave the accurate impression, right? It's small caliber, low muzzle velocity, not particularly lethal round. what folks took an issue with, they took an issue with two things that I said, one of which I stand by based on my sources, and one of which I definitely got wrong. So the first was that I said that the 22 rimfire is the most popular ammo in the world. And that I stand, people have said, no, this is more popular. This, and people have sent me things. That came not only from the overall summary article on Wikipedia, type in 22 rimfire in Wikipedia, but also I read, I went to a gun enthusiast site and read pages about ammo. Okay. Wow. Obviously not enough, but you know, I do real work for you people. And that also said, you know, that literally there are over a billion rounds of 22 rimfire ammo are sold. And so that still seems correct, right? It's a massively popular form of ammunition. What I said off the cuff, and this is my liberal East Coast elite bias showing, was I said it is a standard hunting bullet. And that's because when I think, I've never been hunting, as I've said, I've never fired a firearm. I don't have anything against it. I would be happy to go to a target range. I've got a client that actually runs a target range. I'd love to go, you know, do some target shooting. I think it'd be really, really cool. But I've never fired a gun. I've never been hunting. So I am picturing the Mitt Romney, you know, small varmints hunting, right? And people who hunt, I don't know, rhino or, are you would never use, you know, a 22 to hunt anything bigger than a squirrel.
I feel like you're digging
rabbit.
Yourself into a bigger hole with all this. People are going to be there was only one thing you were wrong about. And now there's 13.
Yeah. No, well, look, it's correct. If you are a game hunter, you would not use a 22 because, again, it's a low powered ammunition, and so it
you're
won't
picturing
take down a
shooting
deer.
At some, you know, birds, mosquitoes,
right? Yeah, I was picturing varmint hunting, right?
Large
you know,
insects, yeah.
Yeah, the kind of things that, you know, quail and rabbit and, you know, stuff like that. All right. That's on the ammunition. Look, I try and put the disclaimers around it, and I stand by our discussion in that, right? In which we, I think, pointed out, you know, several things that, I think were meant to, describe the interests of hunters in evaluating the legislation, and flagged for you at the outset that I am not a gun owner or user, and I don't I am not a hunter. So I did my best, and I think I gave you guys a fair shake in the actual substance of the discussion, but I did get that detail wrong. So that's number one.
All right.
Moving on. Number two, I said it is up to the states to determine whether they want daylight savings time or not. And a couple people wrote it to say, as it turns out, that's not entirely true.
Oh, really?
This is crazy.
I'll say for my part, this was me springing this on. I sprung forward or whatever. No, I put this on you. No notice. So I'm going to, you know. I'll give you give you that. Just make sure people don't think you couldn't even research that.
And so then I went and researched it, and it is 15 U.S.C. Section 260A, which says this is a federal daylight savings time mandate, and it says during the period commencing at 2 o'clock antemeridian on the second Sunday of March of each year. But, you know, so it sets up daylight savings time, and it says the standard time of each zone shall be advanced 1 hour, right? And then it says, however, any state that lies entirely within one time zone may by law exempt itself from the provisions of the subsection, but only if that law provides that the entire state shall observe the standard time otherwise applicable during that period. Okay, so in other words, states can choose not to go on daylight savings time, which if I had just said that then I wouldn't have to do it. Andrew was wrong. But I think I said it's up to them to decide how to implement daylight savings time. And the federal law says if you're a state that's entirely within one time zone, you can choose to stay on standard time. But what you can't do is something that at least one state is trying to do. The state of Florida, they've passed a bill where they want to go on daylight savings time year round. Now, Thomas, so you're never moving to Florida. When you retire, you're going to stay where you are. But Florida has actually just passed House Bill 1013 for year-round daylight savings time. It is called the Sunshine Protection Act. And it says, provided that the Congress amends 15 U.S.C. 260A, then we want to go on daylight savings time.
So it's kind of a weird quirk where it's like, well, maybe it's not a quirk. You tell me, but that seems like something that I wouldn't have thought had I had just read the law, but they can stay on standard time, but they can't stay on the daylight savings time. So
exactly
that would essentially,
right.
I don't know the plus or minus, but would that put them in central time when they should be Eastern or something like that?
No, what it would do is it would put them in Atlantic time.
Oh,
right?
Okay. They go an hour.
1 hour ahead of the East Coast. Right.
Gotcha.
So
that would be interesting.
Yeah, it would be. It would be neat. And apparently, like, this is a huge pet cause of Marco Rubio. So it's good to know that America's
that's
laziest
what he's been
senator
doing all
cares
this
about
time.
Something. Yeah.
That's what he's been doing. We thought he was doing nothing and hiding, but he's actually been working on this critical daylight savings bill. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's
we
what motivates
Marco Rubio, everybody.
All right. Man. Number three, this is just a Mick. I just misspoke because I knew this. In our update on Pennsylvania gerrymandering, I said Pennsylvania has a Republican governor. They just elected a Democratic governor, Tom Wolf. Which I knew. And again, I think I said the Republicans refused to redraw the map. Again, that was a misstatement coming out of my mouth that the Republicans took a crack at redrawing the map, but they basically moved the lines, you know, a couple of feet, right? They did very little redrawing of the map that they then resubmitted that the Supreme Court decided was insufficient to resolve their concerns. So that's just a clean whiff, and I gotta take my lumps on that one.
All right, fair enough.
No. Number four, recent report from Facebook. This is not an Andrew was wrong, but it is an update that says Cambridge Analytica may have received Facebook profiles of up to 83 million people.
Oh, I saw this, yeah.
So at the time we went to press, they were saying up to 50 million people. It's really amazing the way that Facebook can cross-reference and drill down and provide that level of data. And so the number's up to 83 million. And then number five, this is the big one. This is the reason for doing the segment, but you know, but all the other ones are you know, they are what they are. In episode 160, we talked about the fate of the emoluments lawsuit. And our buddy, Seth Barrett Tillman, who has filed the amicus brief in connection with that lawsuit, arguing, as he did on the show, that the emoluments clause, that the foreign emoluments clause, does not apply to the president of the United States. For reasons you can go back in the archives. It's episodes 46 and 47. And hear our interview with Professor Tillman, which I think all parties are satisfied with that interview. I certainly liked it. I think Professor Tillman liked it. He's still listening to the show, which is great. So I described what happens when you lose a motion to dismiss and you proceed to discovery. In other words, it's not immediately appealable, which is correct. In this case, however, the district court, Judge Macit, has only heard arguments on the motion to dismiss for lack of standing, and there remain additional motions to dismiss that are pending. So the case is not immediately proceeding to discovery. The case is proceeding to briefing and then a one-day oral argument on, and Professor Tillman was good enough to send us the scheduling order that said, having decided that plaintiffs have standing to pursue this litigation, the court wishes to hear oral argument on the remaining issues raised in the president's motion to dismiss, namely the meaning of the term emolument and whether the plaintiffs have stated claims under the emoluments clauses of the U.S. Constitution. And the court is prepared to devote a full day to oral argument. That order also provides that the parties are anticipated to raise any arguments that are raised in the amicus briefs, that the amicus parties will not be present to argue. So,
I guess there's a good reason why Seth Tillman was aware of this.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because they're going to take up his argument and they're going to argue it on his behalf. I am really, really interested. Judge Macit is a colleague of mine. We serve on the Federal Bar Association together. So when the argument is scheduled, I am going to do my best to be in that courtroom to hear the argument, because I'm really, really interested in how the Trump side makes that argument and whether they make Professor Tillman's argument. So if I can go, I'm going to go. We'll do a little live reporting. But yeah, it's a really, really important clarification. And
you can do, do some sketches of the, I guess a different thing, but yeah, do some sketches of everybody in there.
Yeah, it will be a slightly different issue than do you remember the SNL sketches with the Unabomber sketch where
I think I do, but I was super little, so I like barely remember.
They were great Norm MacDonald routines. So and for our new listeners,
you're saying I should learn it when I do my Norm MacDonald impression?
Exactly. Thomas does the world's best Norm MacDonald.
All right, let's move on to the B segment here. Got the trade tariffs.
Move on. Let's let Norm take us in.
Yeah, we could just pretend that Norm does our like voiceover for between the segments every episode. Well, Andrew was wrong about those things, and shame on you, Andrew. That's all I have to say.
I own up to it.
Yeah. Andrew, what's going on with these tariffs against China? I know that it's really eating into my retirement savings. I can tell you that. Stock market is tanking because of this, and other things. But talk about it. Yeah, what's happening?
So here's the factual pattern. The Trump administration announced tariffs of up to $60 billion on Chinese imports. And $60 billion sounds like a lot. You know, look, I wouldn't mind $60 billion. The Chinese economy is $11 trillion, right? So it's not the actual impact in terms of hurting China is, I think, relatively low. The question is how is it going to affect U.S. citizens? This is an area where Donald Trump has rewritten the Republican Party. This is a legitimate distinction between Donald Trump and, as far as I know, every major Republican candidate for president from the latter half of the 20th century onward. The Republican Party has historically been, because of their association with big business, also the party of free trade. And Democrats, who were historically the party of unions, have been associated with protectionism. The last Democrat I remember that explicitly ran on a protectionist platform was Bill Bradley in 1992. So that's what the Trump administration announced. In retaliation, China announced increased tariffs on, and I've seen this reported in two different ways, either 106 or 128 categories of U.S. goods, which again are expected to total about $60 billion in tariffs. I'm going to link, CNBC has the full list of 106 categories, these are a lot of raw materials, right? A lot of agricultural products. So the top seven are black soybean, yellow soybean, corn flour, uncombed cotton linters, and sorghum. Those all happen to be agricultural products which have subsidies, right? So there are tremendous surpluses, particularly of corn in the United States. And tariffs on those goods directly hurt U.S. exporters of those goods. But so the question is, how can the Trump administration just do this, right? This seems like it would be the kind of thing that would require a law. And the answer is that there is an existing law.
Congress delegated it to the president?
Yeah, Congress delegated it to the president 44 years ago. The Trade Act of 1974.
Sounds right.
Which is 19 U.S.C. 2101 et sec. And the special application of how the Trade Act of 1974 works here is what I think is worth kind of delving into. subsection 2411, which is referred to, if you see, if you go deep into any of the news stories, you might see something referred to as a Section 301 report pursuant to the Trade Act of 1974. That was how it was numbered in the original bill, but it has since when you number something in the bill and then you stick it in the U.S. code in the middle of other laws, it winds up getting renumbered. So this Section 301, you can't find it at Section 301. You have to find it at Section 2411. Anyway, that's just a little bit on my research for these kinds of laws. Section 301 does a couple of things, right? So as you surmised, it delegates authority, and in particular, it delegates authority to the U.S. Trade Representative, who is an executive branch official who is appointed by and serves at the pleasure of the president. So he can be fired for political reasons and replaced, which is what Donald Trump did upon assuming office. And he appointed Robert Lighthizer as the U.S. Trade Representative. Robert Lighthizer, ex-Covington and Burling guy, but also conservative activist who is protectionist, who believes that tariffs with China are important. So with that in mind, what does the Section 301 do? It imposes certain requirements on the USTR, and one of them is every year the United States Trade Representative's office must publish a list that identifies countries that do not provide, quote, adequate and effective protection of intellectual property rights. And that's published every year. It's published on or before April 30th of each year. So we have 2017, but not 2018. And I'm going to make a prediction right here. We'll do what Andrew was wrong if I'm wrong, but don't think I'm going to be. So there are two classifications that are significant under Section 301. The highest classification is priority foreign countries, which are defined as those foreign countries that have the most onerous or egregious acts, policies, or practices that deny adequate and effective intellectual property rights or deny fair and equitable market access to U.S. persons that rely on intellectual property protection. And there's some other stuff. But basically, the worst IP violators. There are presently no countries that are listed as a priority foreign country, and there haven't been for several years. The next step down is a categorization called priority watch list, and that means that the country has not been designated a priority foreign country, but we're watching it to see if it deserves to be elevated to that category. And China has been on the priority watch list since 2006, but they are not designated as a priority foreign country. So my fearless prediction is when this list comes out in 3 weeks,
they will be designated
as a priority foreign country. So countries that are designated as a priority foreign country, there are some presumptive actions that the U.S. Trade Representative can undertake against them subject to subsection A. That's not the case here. So what applies is subsection B, which allows discretionary action, which says if the U.S. Trade Representative determines that an act, policy, or practice of a foreign country is unreasonable or discriminatory and burdens or restricts U.S. commerce, and action by the U.S. is appropriate, then the U.S. Trade Representative shall take all appropriate and feasible action, and then that can include to suspend, withdraw, or prevent the application of benefits of trade agreement concessions to carry out a trade agreement, impose duties or other import restrictions on the goods of and fees or restrictions or the services of any such country. And so essentially, I could continue to read, but you get the idea. It delegates unbelievable latitude to the U.S. Trade Representative to undertake a variety of what you would think of and what I would describe as legislative acts that the USTR can undertake unilaterally if the USTR, in his judgment, ascertains that a country is engaged in activity which is insufficiently protective of intellectual property rights. That explains why all of the text you see coming out of the White House in conjunction with these tariffs, which, by the way, the largest tariffs, as I've come to understand it, are on raw materials like aluminum, right? They are the
that's not like intellectual property. Yes.
It absolutely is not. But the justification is an intellectual property justification. And if you read the stories,
because I was going to say, I don't want to embarrass myself, but I thought prior to this whole tariff thing, I thought the intellectual property thing was a real problem, like that China was actually doing, you know, was not respecting US and was like requiring people to give up their intellectual property in kind of an unfair way. I thought that's a real issue, right? Not just like,
no, it absolutely is. But there is absolutely no connection between the tariffs.
Ah, so they're using a real issue to have one, two, three, four. I
exactly
declare
right.
a trade
and
war.
And you do not see Donald Trump posing with, you know, tech companies and saying, hey, look, you know, we are protecting your intellectual property rights overseas. Where he is posing is at steel mills, right? He is saying we are protecting the raw inputs for American manufacturing, again, because of the political realignment.
Andrew, I have an idea for a fantastic invention. I've drawn up a diagram. It's called metal. That's my different metal. That's my invention. Patent that. Can I use PA Torres
law? We will get you.
Yeah. PA Torres at patorres.com. Patent my invention of really, really hard thing that.
The justification is that the tariffs on things like aluminum are designed to target Chinese policies that coerce American companies from transferring technology and intellectual property to local Chinese companies. And if that seems slightly nonsensical mouth verbiage to you, all I can tell you is I didn't write it. But in terms of the law, it 100% authorized by the Trade Act of 1974. The scope of authority makes it very, very clear that the USTR can undertake actions without regard. This is the final sub-provision of subparagraph 4 says that the USTR can undertake such actions without regard to whether or not such goods or economic sector were involved in the act, policy, or practice that is the subject of such action. And look, again, if you take yourself back to 1974, before the government was broken, and look, this is the reign of Richard Nixon, right? Like that's now qualifies as the good old days. But if you go back to 1974,
back when we could trust the government,
you would say, yeah, look, we do not want, we understand that tariffs in one area may affect policy in another area, right? It is perfectly sensible to understand why you would have that exception. But the net result of this is you have a delegation, a broad, open-ended delegation of authority from the legislative branch to the executive branch. I'll make another prediction. I think, you know, during the term of our next president, I'm on record as thinking that's going to be Elizabeth Warren, but whoever it is, I think you're going to see a sea change in how laws get written, if any laws get written, and the Congress is going to greatly reduce the scope of delegation of legislative authority to the executive branch without oversight in things like that, because I think that relationship. I don't ever see there being a relationship of trust again between the legislative and executive branches. It's just one of the many reasons why we continue to report on Donald Trump the way we report on Donald Trump. But there you go. That's how he can unilaterally start a trade war without going to Congress.
Yeah. I figured it was that sort of thing. But this is really it's really frustrating me, this whole trade war thing. Did you see the headline that this is the worst start to a year since 1929 in terms of the stock market? Now, who knows what that means, but, you know, it could be just a bad selection of months here. But yeah, it's really for other people like me who, you know, just for fun, keep an eye on their 401k, you know, what little I have invested to see how the stock market's doing. Shocking dip that
it has taken
this year.
And again, let's, you know, our political biases are clear and we disclose them. One of the things that we push back on is when, you know, Obama was president, when you have a Democrat in office and all of a sudden the stock market is going gangbusters and there is no kind of direct governmental policy that, look, yeah, right. You know, presidents are take too much credit when the stock market goes up and, you know, are probably blamed unfairly when they go down.
Well, in the short term, the short term, certainly. But I mean, you can look at the overall trend of Obama's 8 years of taking us from a crash to back to prosperity. I feel like that long of a trajectory, perhaps he has something to do with
it. Yeah, no, agreed. And, yeah, and I just wanted to contrast that with, this is not, right, overarching trends about the economy, which is cyclical, which, you know, doesn't, you know, there are a great many trends that have nothing to do with the inhabitant of the White House. This is in direct response to what the White House has done, right? This is, if ever there were a direct line between presidential action and the stock market, this certainly qualifies. And again, it represents, you know, I find myself, you know, this is the conservative wing of the Democratic Party is the pro free trade party, right? Like, I mean, it was, you know, the Bernie Sanders supporters chanting, you know, pull out of the TPP. And I have long kind of identified, with the, you know, pro capitalist, pro foreign trade wing of the Democratic Party. And this is a real realignment. I want to end with, because I think this is truly amazing. I am going to link it. It's a New York Times article that I dug up while researching that flew beneath the radar. But Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin at the end of February, right? So 6 weeks ago, floated the idea of the U.S. rejoining the TPP, right? That Donald Trump very famously, to great fanfare, pulled out of on his third day in office. And, you know, and we're talking tough about sanctions on China. And certainly within the Trump administration, it would not surprise me if, you know, you have this very public optics of imposing tariffs and cutting back on free trade, while at the same time they enact precisely the same policies that were used as a wedge issue against Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. So we'll link that one. Yeah,
it's a joke. It's absolutely a joke. But thanks for the breakdown. I think, you know, it might be interesting to have maybe on another forum sometime. It is interesting the political issues that Trump has driven both sides to. You know, it's like, because Democrats are doing it a little bit too, but I think that's a topic for another show. But thanks for that breakdown, and on to our next segment.
All right.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Okay, Yodel Mountain, we've got our ale in our hands and we're hearing the delightful Yodel Mountain music. What's going on? I heard that the first person was sentenced, right?
Yeah. In episode 160, we went through the sentencing memorandum for Alex van der Zwaan, who was the Dutch lawyer working at Skadden Arps, who deleted emails and obstructed the Mueller investigation. And I get a lot of questions from our friends on the left who said, boy, it seems kind of weird that he only got 6 months. You know, is the fix in? What's going on here? And I thought this might not be a bad time to discuss the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines and why van der Zwaan only got 6 months and why I wouldn't read the tea leaves that way. So I'm going to include a link to the federal sentencing guidelines in the show notes. But essentially, the way in which it works in federal court is you have a table, right? It's actually called the sentencing table. And the columns are your criminal history category, right? And you get, here's the way it works. For every prior conviction you have that resulted in a sentence of less than 60 days, you get 1 point. for every prior conviction you have that was between 60 days and 13 months. And I'll explain why it's 13 months and not a year in a minute. You get 2 points. And for every prior conviction that you have a sentence greater than 13 months, you get 3 points. And then the columns are 0 to 1, 2 to 3, 4 to 6, 7 to 9.
It's like a Sudoku, and then you have
13
to...
or more. Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's 6 columns across, and as you go right, it's, you know, you have more of a criminal history, right?
Right.
And then the rows are 43 different offense levels, okay?
That's a
and
lot.
Then
Jeez.
For every federal crime, you go to this huge sentencing manual, and you start with the base offense level, which is defined for each and every crime. And then you adjust that offense level for what the offender's role was in the offense, for if there was any obstruction. And so, you know, for example, if you were decided, if the government takes the position that you minimally participated in the crime and the judge agrees, then they can decrease that base offense level by 4. Right. On the other hand, if you obstructed justice, then you can raise the offense level by 2. And there are lots of other. I mean, we can't go through the entire operation. Vanderzwan pled guilty to 18 U.S.C. 1001, making a false statement to the Mueller investigation. That carries a base offense level of 6, and the sentence for somebody with no prior criminal history and a base offense level of 6 falls within what they consider zone A, which is 0 to 6 months, which very, very often, I mean, in a great many cases, that means you get probation, right? That means you serve literally no time in jail.
Right.
To have increased out of zone A and into zone B means that one of two things happened. Right. Either there were sufficient, because even if you add on the 2 points for obstructing justice, that only gets you to 8, and that's still in zone A. Right? 1 through 8 is all in zone A, and they're all crimes for which people who are first-time offenders typically serve no time in jail. To get into
zone
B,
you really
had
to do some decoding on this. This is
yeah. You really do. You really do. To get into zone B or to get the high range of zone A means that the judge took seriously.
Andrew, by the way, has one of those Turing machines that was in that you saw in that movie. He had to and then figure out the sentencing.
It's an abacus, actually.
Yeah.
It's a huge abacus on the wall behind me.
Definitely simpler.
So at any rate, what it means is that the judge took the government's sentencing memorandum seriously. This was somebody who could have served no time and will serve the maximum in zone A. And so you should not read it that way as, you know, oh, 6 whole months. This means, you know, the courts don't care about Mueller's investigation or the fixes in or whatever the lefty, you know, Occupy Democrats, the fear mongering was about. No, this means that they took it seriously. Okay. So
it doesn't mean that there's any, like, do we know if he could have been guilty of other stuff but pled down or something, or is it any one of those scenarios?
Yeah, well, look, he pled guilty and the government accepted his plea to one charge of 18 U.S.C. 1001. So could they absolutely could have charged him with more than one count, and they decided not to. We don't know the reason for that because, again, obviously this is not somebody who was cooperating, and it doesn't appear like this is somebody that they need in any event. You know, this is somebody who deleted the emails and lied to Mueller.
Gotcha.
That may have just been, if you ask me what I think likely happened there is a prosecutor will plea bargain defendants to something that represents kind of the fair outcome in their mind of, you know, between whatever risk they think there is of this guy getting off versus what they could prove if they went to trial. And, you know, they may have made the judgment, you know, Mueller and his team may have made the judgment of, yeah, you know what, like, this is a first time guy. And the jury is really going to convict on one offense here, right? They're going to convict on the basis of him deleting the email and lying to us about it. And they're going to call that one thing. So if we can get him to plead to that one thing, let's call it a day and save the state, save, you know, the federal government the expense of a trial. That's, again, hard for me to be in Mueller's head, but if you ask me, if you ask me to do that, that's where I would come out.
Okay, sounds right. Yeah, so it's not as though you're just saying that some people thought maybe this meant there was no there, as they say, but you're saying no, this is just pretty standard.
Yeah,
it's actually on the harsher side of for that particular thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay,
and I would add as a footnote, we cited some reporting in our story on Vanderswaan that suggested that the person identified as person A in the sentencing memorandum was Konstantin Kalimnik, an individual with known ties to Russian intelligence. That has now been confirmed, and I will link an article from Business Insider that that identifies person A, Konstantin Kalimnik. It seemed like it was the case back in 160, but we had to put error bars around it because it was just reporting, and now this seems to be common knowledge. So, yeah, let's remember while we're talking about you know, this lawyer getting 6 months in jail, this is the link between the Trump campaign in October of 2016, a month before election, and an official with then extant ties to Russian intelligence. So that's why this is on Yodel Mountain.
All right.
The other Yodel Mountain worthy legal occurrence this week is Paul Manafort's motion to dismiss, which we covered his companion lawsuit, but it raises the same arguments in 136, in which Paul Manafort.
I mean, this guy is so guilty, yeah. Right? It's not like just dismiss everything, cuz.
Yeah. Well, and his cuz argument is this is beyond the scope of the Mueller investigation. I am going to link the government's reply memorandum. I'm going to link the government's response memorandum to the motion to dismiss because it is just devastating. It confirms, nice. It uses the same. I don't want to take any credit for this because it's patently obvious what we said in 136, right? Like when we went through and evaluated Manafort's claims in 136, I said, that the Rosenstein investigation, I said that the Rosenstein memo appointing Mueller as special counsel very clearly extended to Manafort in this case, and that it was authorized to do so in that breadth of language by 28 U.S.C. 515. And that is the position that the government has taken in its opposition. There are the arguments presented under both sections, right? So Rosenstein's memo says that Mueller is authorized to investigate any links and or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump. And the government says, look, an investigation of possible links and or coordination between the Russian government in its political interference campaign and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump would naturally cover ties that a former Trump campaign manager had to Russian associated political operatives, Russian backed politicians, and Russian oligarchs. I want to point out, this is the government, right? This is Mueller's team, how they are describing their investigation in this opposition. That is not, that's not Andrew's, characterization there. That is the government's characterization there. You know, it would naturally look to any interactions, right? And look, it is beyond obvious, right? If Manafort were being blackmailed by the Russians, for example, and again, there's no evidence of that. But when you're asking, is this within the jurisdiction of the investigation? It is very plainly within the subpoint one jurisdiction of the investigation, because even if Manafort were being investigated, even if Manafort were vulnerable to blackmail based on conduct prior to the 2016 campaign, that vulnerability could be manifest during the 2016 campaign, right? So the Manafort and the Fox talking points that say, look, all of this is from, you know, long before the election. Well, that's not an excuse, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, I appreciate you going through all this, but like, we all know this.
Yeah.
This is about when your last leg is well, you shouldn't have been looking for this, guys.
Yeah.
Like, for that's your excuse for the crime.
Yeah, but
that's probably not the best.
No, it's not. But it what I think is significant is in connection with the government preparing its opposition, they released an internal memorandum, private memorandum from Rod Rosenstein to Special Counsel Mueller that specifically confirmed that Mueller was authorized to undertake these sorts of investigations, and redacted portions of that memo have been made public. It is totally legitimate. It's completely contemplated by the statute that the guidance in interpretation can come in the form of a private memorandum. So there's nothing wrong about that. And that is the official position of the acting attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, is that, yes, the Mueller investigation is wide ranging. So that's the real significance of this, is the takeaway. It's not, you know, yeah, Manafort's going to lose. We all know that. Manafort's going to jail. The significance is it continues to be a right-wing talking point that you know, Mueller is off the reservation and he's investigating stuff that isn't the campaign. Right. And Rod Rosenstein, again, I want to go back what I said when he appointed Mueller as special counsel. Rod Rosenstein, lifetime conservative Republican, somebody I know well, and somebody who you cannot paint this person as a rhino or as a, you know, liberal Republican. He is none of those things. He is a lifetime conservative Republican, and he has confirmed, and it has been released, that the Mueller investigation is authorized to cover precisely the sorts of things that are, we think, likely to bring down the president. So,
all right. Yeah, no, definitely. It's as I was saying after I read that book, The Fire and Fury, that it really did seem like Mueller was Rosenstein's revenge on Trump.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that ends up being true. I mean, who knows how reliable that book was, but that was certainly the impression that I was left with after reading it. So we'll see. Yeah. All right, it is time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over at patreon.com/law. Hope you enjoyed our little, we'll just say, double lot awful movies this month. You got a 2-for-1 deal. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And that was a lot of fun. So, but anyway, we've got to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, and they are a vegan who usually doesn't poison meat at the grocery store. Wow, okay. All right. Anonymous. My semi cousin Vinny, who shares three of the same mothers. What is that? Kapler Bullpen Management Incorporated. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. Matthew Vernon is engaged to sexy badass Elisa.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for the phonetics there. Wow. All right. Congratulations. So I guess that was real. I don't know if it was like, you know, like she heard it here first or anything necessarily, but that was sounds like a real proposal. They're engaged now. Congratulations.
I like to imagine that Matthew, you know, called out, had one of the like Alexa devices and was like, Alexa, use AnyPod to play opening arguments, and sat there and waited. And then as they're about to get to,
hun, listen, yeah. You will sit and listen to Andrew. Do not move.
And then did the, like, you know, you're at the movies and you're a teenager, like stretching, kind of getting up out of the chair as we're about to read our Hall of Fame patrons, and then drop to one knee. I have this whole story in my head. But anyway, congratulations, you two.
Thanks to Heather Leverage, Aaron Grady, Adam Lenda, Alec Emke, Soggy Pants, Foxhole Atheist, Sam Deneau, Eli Bosnick. My ag law class had me believing half the law was about fences and continues, but that sounds
that's
funny.
That's true.
Yeah, it's always get cut off. Pugs and Kisses, Ian and Ali, Elon Wool is now changing his name to Thomas Smith so as not to confuse. Good idea. Dave, reluctant investor in Thomas's Second Chance Surgery Center, Nichols. Jim Grove, Soul, Philosophical Zombies with Pitchforks and Glow Sticks, Malika Chandler, a poorly named user. I listened the whole hour because dedication. Cineplenus Pisces. I don't know what that is. MH World Purge the Pickle. What? Is giving all my money to podcasters mismanagement? I certainly don't think so. Wow, thank you guys so much.
Yep, and thank you to Squick Thinger, to Classic, CampQuest.org, 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 Tricicular Manslaughter, Philip Stromberg, The Wayward Willis Podcast, Occam's Chainsaw Massacre, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, our first patron, Danny Rosari. Shout out, thank you for being with us from the very beginning. Reasonable Risk Podcast, Reagan Klein, Rhonda the Dork, Roger, but the sign said all you could eat Metcalf versus Frying Dutchman. Great Simpsons lawsuit there. Sammy, C6 Sarah, the Make Hater Cake Baker, Bake Gay Bay's Great Gay Cake Case, Stephen Lester, the law offices of Vincent LaGuardia Gambini, defending Utes since 1992. Danny Baker, that's all. No Joey Jojo Shabadoo or any other crazy long name. Adopt a Homeless Special Prosecutor and Oppose Collusion and Obstruction, Sakashite Fukasumi, Frederick Alstromer, Stormy Daniels for Attorney General. Yeah, I can get behind that. Sentient Thought Experiment Machine, Stop Breaking the Law Asshole, Liz Go Orange Weeks, Mitchell, Adopt a Fabricated Shipping Tycoon and Oppose Import-Export Taxes. Comerica Park now serves Yodel Mountain Beer, and our top patron, as always, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much. We hope you enjoyed the Lawed Awful movies and all the other perks that come from being a patron. And you want to join their ranks? Head on over, patreon.com/law. $5 an episode, and we will read whatever ridiculous name you want us to read every single week.
Yep. That is a fun segment. I love those names. Thanks, guys.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. It is time for Thomas Takes the Bar Exam, TGBE. And I think I'm on a little bit of a hot streak on this.
Yeah, right? You were on a three-question hot streak. So 39 for 69.
Time to get one wrong.
Yeah, no. This will make you 40 for 70, which is a nice, powers of 10. I think you're going to get there. So.
All right.
Are you ready?
Sure.
A lumber supplier agreed to sell to a furniture manufacturer all the lumber that the manufacturer required over a 2-year period. The sales contract provided that the payment was due 60 days after delivery, but that a 3% discount would be allowed if the manufacturer paid within 10 days of delivery. Now, during the first year of the contract, the manufacturer regularly paid within the 10-day period and received the 3% discount. But 15 days after the supplier had made its most recent lumber delivery to the manufacturer, the supplier had received no payment from the manufacturer. At the time, the supplier became aware of rumors from a credible source that the manufacturer's financial condition was precarious. The supplier called the manufacturer, demanding assurances regarding the manufacturer's financial status. The manufacturer immediately mailed to the supplier its latest audited financial statements, as well as a satisfactory credit report prepared by the manufacturer's banker. The rumors proved to be false. Nevertheless, the supplier refused to resume deliveries. The manufacturer sued the supplier for breach of contract. Will the manufacturer likely prevail? Okay.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Okay.
So A, no, because the contract was unenforceable since the manufacturer had not committed to purchase a definite quantity of lumber. B, no, because the supplier had reasonable grounds for insecurity and was therefore entitled to cancel the contract and refuse to make any future deliveries. C, yes, because the credit report and audit financial statements provided adequate assurance of due performance under the contract. D, yes, because the supplier was not entitled to condition resumption of deliveries on the receipt of financial status information.
Interesting. Okay. All right. So this one's a little weird. What I'm finding funny about this question is like we got the buyer and the seller, essentially. The seller is sending the stuff and then is supposed to get payment. Right. They don't get payment within 15 days. And then they're like, hey, are you sure your financial condition's good? And instead of just sending the payment, they send like financials and stuff, which is weird. But so that's throwing me off because like they haven't actually paid for this last shipment. But I guess it's due 60 days. So that's why. So they had time to send all the financials and stuff, but they didn't want to send the payment. So the payment is due 60 days after delivery. So I guess from what we can tell, we're still in the timeline here. We're still well within the window of delivery for the payment. So I guess the key issue is, can you terminate a contract when you think that the buyer is not going to be able to pay or is in some sort of financial trouble, even though they've, you know, provided evidence that they aren't? That seems to be the issue, I guess. So we've got A, no, because the contract was unenforceable since the manufacturer not committed to purchase of a definite quantity of lumber. That looks like one of those, you know, get out of jail free cards of the whole question. It's like a different issue. Can you have a contract that says we'll agree to sell for 2 years, but not a quantity? That's a good question. My instinct would be, yes, you can have that kind of a contract. But I don't know. Maybe I'll be wrong about that. B, no, because the supplier had reasonable grounds for insecurity. That's an interesting one because it seems like there are not any reasonable grounds here. I mean, if this is reasonable grounds for insecurity, then anything is. Then any feeling that you could possibly have would be reasonable grounds. And I feel like that, if this is the issue, if I'm spotting the issue correctly, I don't feel like that is right. Yes, because the credit report and audit financial statements provided adequate assurance of due performance under the contract. That would be what I would lean toward. And then finally, D, yes, because the supplier was not entitled to condition resumption of deliveries upon the receipt of financial status information. So the two yeses look more attractive to me than the two noes. I'm going to eliminate B because I really just think there's no grounds for insecurity here, like 100% zero reasonable grounds. So I'm going to eliminate B. I guess there's a chance A could be right. So just for my second chance law firm purposes, maybe I should try to eliminate a yes answer, you know, or I could go, you know, I could go for it and just eliminate both the no answers. Let's see, which of the yes answers is more likely? I think the C yes answer is more likely, but gosh, D, yes, because the supplier is not entitled to condition resumption of deliveries on the receipt of financial status information. Gosh, that's like one of those slightly, like it's the same answer, but it's a little different, you know, like C is saying, okay, well, we gave you the financial statements and we're good. And D is saying, well, no, you couldn't really, you had no right to even require us to provide that. So I don't know. I'm going to eliminate D because I'm hoping that's just a worse yes. So I'm going to go between A and C, and I'm going to hope that I've done my issue spotting and that the answer is straightforward. C, but I think there's all kinds of opportunities for me to be wrong because of some issue that I don't know anything about. So I'm going with C, yes, because the credit report, blah, 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 due performance. They're well within the timeline of payment. That's what I think it is.
So our listeners, never let it be said that Thomas does not work hard for you and take seriously his obligations to take the bar exam. I thought that was great the way you worked through that. I'm not commenting on the answer because that would be contrary to the spirit of the game. But I think none of our lawyers and law students listening could possibly fault your issue spotting and bringing this question to ground. So
what you're saying is you're seeing me spin my wheels real hard and trying to answer it, but I don't have like the data that I need to answer it.
Well, we'll
hope Brian cleaned it up so that wasn't a half hour of me stumbling over that question. Hopefully it was only like 2 minutes of me stumbling over that question.
So if you would like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on Twitter or Facebook. Include the hashtag TTTB so we can find it. Include your answer and your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winning answer or our most hilarious losing answer. We'll pick something and we will shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys. Thanks so much for Andrew. And keep an eye on Yodel Mountain. It's always tasty brews up there and fun
crack
times with
open
friends. But yeah. And thanks so much for seriously all the participation, the emails, everything. It's really fun to be doing this show. And that's because of you guys. And we will see you for another episode on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. for questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.